This is Irish Stephen Bear from Deep Space Nine, and you are listening to The Shuttle Pod. You lucky sons of bitches.
Welcome back, friends, to the Shuttle Pod, episode 43. We have put Shuttle Pod at the Disco on hiatus, as the series is on a little break until January, and so we have returned to our regularly scheduled bi-weekly thematic programming, rather than talking about Discovery episode by episode, as exciting as that was to have new Star Trek for the first time in 2005. Since 2005. My name is Jared Whitley. I am co-hosting today along with my good friends Brian Drew.
Hello, everybody.
And, of course, Matt Wright.
Hello, gents. How's it going?
Guys, are we excited to be back at the Shuttle Pod?
Yeah, this is good.
It feels kind of weird, actually.
Yeah. Doesn't it?
And there's no sense of urgency to get, you know, to just immediately talk about something. We've got to ponder this week's topic a little.
Yeah, the Disco podcasts were a whole different rhythm.
Yet we knew exactly what it is we had to talk about with those. It was very directed.
Yep, it was.
Before we get into it, I want to mention that the Shuttle Pod podcast is brought to you all by the humans at Bye Bye Robot, purveyors of fine art from the future. Bye Bye Robot sells officially licensed Star Trek art made by multiple talented artists in many different styles at prices starting around $25. Go to byebyerobot.com to learn more. And this is a perfect time of year to be buying gifts for people. So add Bye Bye Robot to your friends and family's wish lists. Okay. So today, Matt, what are we talking about today in the context of Discovery? It's not about Discovery specifically, but in that context, what are we talking about?
Ah, well, we're talking about how Discovery is perhaps one of the first, like specifically anyway, set up to be serialized Trek TV shows ever. So we want to talk about that. And how does that feel versus episodic storytelling?
Yeah, so serialization means kind of more like a soap opera where in order to appreciate any show, you need to have seen the last dozen or so to have context, whereas episodic means you can pluck any one episode out of the air and watch it, and you don't need any additional context, really.
Right.
Now, and historically, like, I mean, I mentioned soap operas. Historically, that was really the only type of TV show that was serialized. And traditionally with episodic TV, as Star Trek had always been, the goal was, of course, with syndication. And the idea of syndication is you just dump the show every night at 10 p.m. for people to watch in reruns for years and years on end. And it doesn't really matter which order they do it in. And the thing that I always kind of reminds me of is like comic books. I mean, Spider-Man has been in thousands of stories. And no matter what the story is, we always have this beginning where Uncle Ben was shot, and then an ending that will never happen, and the story is just in the middle somewhere, right? And it's basically like most TV shows have been. I mean, you get all the information you need in Emissary or in Encounter at Farpoint or in Where No Man Has Gone Before, and then you just take basically any old episode that you watch between then and whenever the show happens to end, and it'll seem to fit, right? But then things changed, right? And serialization became more popular for more than just soap operas. And I want to say that was about the late 90s. And what was it? What was the technological innovation that prompted this?
So the biggest technical innovation is from more like the early 2000s, and that's the TiVo.
People
recording things and time-shifting their viewing. So you know what? It didn't matter in the same way anymore. And people would queue up a few episodes in a row and watch them, you know, when they had time in their busy lives. So suddenly there was this sort of natural move. You know, you could sort of naturally move to something more serial because people were consuming them kind of. Well, now we have a term for it. In the early 2000s, there wasn't really a term.
No.
People are sort of consuming them in small binges.
Yeah.
Thanks to DVR and things like that. And then, of course, now we have streaming that really lets people do that.
Yeah, and in fact, some series are designed to be consumed exactly that way.
Exactly.
And something we've talked about before is I really appreciate that Discovery chose not to do that. I'm glad that we got a little taste of it every week over 7 or 8 weeks, however long it was, rather than being expected to watch everything all at once.
Yeah.
Then there really would have been...
I much prefer it this way.
Yeah. Then there really would have been a sense of urgency for us to have to talk about everything the next day, you know?
Yeah.
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 I personally believe that playing things week to week is far better because it allows you to have more of a communal experience with fellow fans. If we all binged it, we'd all be at different points. Oh, you know, Jared, what episode are you on? Oh, I'm on episode 9. Matt, what do you want? Well, I'm already on 14. And you don't get that chance to sit down with people and be like, wow, you know, last night's show, what was that all about? The water cooler effect thing that started back with Twin Peaks in 1990.
Yep.
You know, and then The Sopranos and Lost and all that other stuff. That was a big thing. It's a cultural event as opposed to something that gets, you know, consumed and then, you know, basically forgotten after a few days.
Right.
Yeah, because you consume it so fast, it doesn't have a chance to digest. There's no opportunity to speculate about, oh, what's going to happen. There's no chance to read about stuff on the internet where they say, oh, remember, well, this happened 2 weeks ago. That's why this moment was significant last night. I mean, I remember when I was at the height of my Game of Thrones watching, like Monday morning, that's what you did was email articles back and forth to your friends about what had happened the night before.
Yep. Yep. And you know, that way, when it's weekly, it stays in the zeitgeist longer.
You keep your media moment open a lot longer.
Right. I mean, look at Stranger Things 2 that came out. What was it, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Right.
And it's already off the landscape. It's gone.
Right. Because they had it out in time for Halloween, and then it's over with, basically.
Right. People burned through it in like 2 or 3 days. It got a bunch of write-ups, you know, reviews and whatnot, a little speculation about the future, and that was it.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, so I think long-term TV is going to go back to a weekly thing. I truly believe that.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. I will say, though, that there are some sort of frustrating points with any show, but especially early on with Discovery, where frustrating is maybe even too hard. It was just, you know, it's like, God, where is this going? I really want to see where this is going. And it would have been kind of nice to say, maybe have the first 4 episodes bingeable. So you really got that background. You got that full, sort of the full palette of what Discovery is about, right? The full.
Certainly the first three.
Yeah, first three for sure. So you had a real flavor of what Discovery is about, because as we know, the first two aren't really the rest of the show. They're a prelude. They're a prequel of sorts that set the stage. So it was really hard to, you know, you really just wanted to, where is this next piece? And it felt really actually kind of mean. Only in this day and age, I think when we binge things, does it feel mean. If this were 10 years ago, it wouldn't feel mean at all. It would feel very normal, right? We just have to wait.
Yeah. But. Yeah, I remember when 24 was really popular that they would do like the first 2 hours of Jack Bauer's day on Sunday and then like the next 2 hours on Monday. So you'd start off with like 4 hours right at the beginning. So basically what you're describing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wish they had done that just to get us really settled and a good, you know, a good flavor of like understanding of what's going on in Discovery. Otherwise, I've been very happy with it being week to week. It's so much fun to wait a week and think about it. And of course, we talk about it in the meantime, and it's great.
Now this, we're digressing a little bit, but that's certainly within the context of the conversation in terms of the episodic versus the serialization. Because if it's episodic, I don't think there's much of a demand to binge. But when it's serialized, there is more of a desire to it, because it's like, oh, what's this to be continued? Basically, every single one.
Yes. Agreed.
So with regards to Discovery, are we enjoying that it's serialized, or do we wish that we're a little bit more like traditional Star Trek of every episode being a self-contained adventure?
So personally, I like the balance that they've struck. It is definitely serialized, and sometimes, like I was talking about, sometimes you feel it more than others. But I think they've also done a great job with some pretty good nearly standalone kind of episodes as well. And it's felt pretty satisfying overall. They've done a pretty good job, I think.
What's an instance where it's worked pretty well?
Well, of course, I think there's one that we all really liked, which was Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad. which was the lovely kind of Groundhog Day Harry Mudd episode. And that one, like, yes, sure, you probably, it would help to know that Harry Mudd was on the Klingon ship and Lorca ditched him, but also he says that very clearly, so you can kind of almost immediately figure this out, because like it's partly a revenge plot, right? So you just kind of go, oh yeah, he was wronged by Lorca, this makes total sense. And you don't even need to have seen it so much to enjoy the time loop shenanigans that goes on, you know. But there are others. I think oh geez, now I'm forgetting the name of the episode, sorry. The one with the Pavans.
Oh yeah, we know it.
The Saru episode.
Yes, that, as we sort of have talked about on this podcast, had a really great potential to be a really great, mostly standalone. Sure, it kind of ties to the larger, you know, issues, but it had the potential to be a really good, very Saru focused episode. They didn't quite, yeah, they didn't quite hit that one out of the park, but again, it definitely does have a lot of, you know, good stuff to stand on its own, because they're mostly exploring a new, you know, a new world, and that's always, you know, encouraging to see and always fun to see, and for the most part stands alone, right? Because there they are on a planet exploring it.
Yeah, as a wise man said, there was a very good episode of Star Trek hidden in there somewhere.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So going forward, it, and maybe you guys are more informed on this than I am, do we expect Discovery to have the same level of serialization, or are they going to shift to doing more episodic storytelling? And what do we want to see, more importantly?
Good question.
I'm fine with serialized stuff with the occasional sprinkling in of standalone.
Yeah. I think it's been fine the way they've done
it. I don't know if the blend is quite working yet with this show completely, but I do like that they are trying to give it a little bit of variety. I don't think the serialized parts of the show are working all that well yet, to be honest. I feel like the show's a little shaky, carrying some of its plot threads through the show. But I do like that they're trying to do different things and, you know, do more of a serialized show one week, expanding the central plot, and then maybe the next week doing a more standalone show. So I do like that blend. It's just, I feel like the show is still finding the right mixture, I guess, would be the what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we also have a very limited sample set to look at, right? It's only a few episodes. And their attitude may have been, well, let's take the first 8 episodes and really set the context for what the next 4 years are going to be. And then it's not going to be quite as continuity heavy going out, but we'll see.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and I know those earliest episodes especially suffer from the fact that they were, you know, the earliest episodes, therefore, so they were some of the earliest written and then rewritten and tweaked as things changed.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's hard.
Yeah. And so anytime you try something more ambitious, the more challenges you have, like the more challenging that will become, right?
Yep.
Because you're trying to run faster than you have strength already, and then you stumble, and so you're going to hit the ground harder, perhaps, potentially.
Yeah. Well, but kudos to them for trying.
Good analogy.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yes, kudos to them for trying.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Just kudos to them for trying. It's something different. It's something kind of, you know, at least for Trek, it's different. For Trek, it's new. I mean, it's fairly new in general, as we were talking about. Really, this idea of serialized TV is maybe less than 10 years old, like, overall. And so it's great. I mean, it's great that they're trying it. And, you know, so.
Now, you mentioned maybe 10 years old. I think it might go back a little bit farther than that. And we talked about this a little bit before we started recording. But, Matt, we were talking about Enterprise and how there was kind of a dramatic shift in the middle of Enterprise. Could you speak to that a little bit, please?
So that is a good point. And thank you for reminding me about my own point, because I had forgotten about that.
Well, yeah, I wrote it down, so I had a little advantage.
Yes. So that is very true. Actually, Trek did for sure dabble, and we can talk about this too, because I don't want to ignore the fact that Deep Space Nine dabbled with it. We'll come back to that. But Enterprise very specifically tried to do something serial in season 3. And that was a whole, again, an arc based around war, with the Zindi War. And that was very serialized. And it's something that's kind of interesting, because if you watch, you know, the really excellent interviews with people like Brandon Braga that are on the Blu-ray sets of Enterprise, they'll you know, these days they're very honest about what happened, and they're very open about things because, well, it's been so long, they can kind of be frank about it. And that they knew that Enterprise is floundering, and so for the first time kind of ever in the franchise, as far as being officially blessed, you know, the UPN suits really did say, go for it. Do this season differently. Like, make it serialized, do something different. And, you know, that's technically the first time a network suit had ever said that about Trek, because as we've talked about, as Jared so well put earlier, typically Trek was very, you know, geared towards syndication, right? We wanted things to be, you know, you hit at least that 100 episode mark so you can syndicate it, and then anyone can watch kind of anything as long as it, you know, when it comes up. So this was kind of a big deal, at least for, you know, the Trek franchise at the time, that, yeah, they officially said, no, do something different, go for it. So, yeah, it was highly serialized.
And now, then, was it like that for just season 3 of Enterprise, or was it for both season 3 and 4?
So season 3 was the most heavily sort of long arc version. And then I think they did something pretty cool for season 4, which was when Manny Coto took over, he decided to try and make some very clear ties, you know, ties forward to the, you know, to the future, with trying to, you know, kind of move things forward closer to TOS. And so he made the whole season is basically kind of small arcs, you know, like two to four episode arcs that move things forward in a more serialized way. But again, they're not a whole season. It's more like, hey, you should probably see the last two, and then you know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember there was like a storyline at the beginning of season 4 and then that storyline at the end, but not as much in between in the rest of the season.
Well, there's the whole augment thing that actually carried forward in two different arcs.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, but that was a three-parter, right?
Yeah, and then it was picked up again as a kind of cute way to explain the Klingon problem.
Oh, the Klingon thing, that's right. Yeah.
Yes.
Is it a genetic mutation or a viral infection?
Yeah.
It turned out to be both. Yeah.
Right. So they did things like that. And of course, they had some cool Vulcan things that finally kind of got the Vulcans on the right path to being much more like the Vulcans we
like expect. Yeah, it took them a while Vulcans. To get there. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a good arc as well.
Yeah. Their logic is in question where the need for forced conflict has arisen.
Yes.
Indeed.
Well said. Thank well you. Quoted, sir.
I do my best. I love that line when Sarek says that in Star Trek 3, where it's like that's the closest he can come to saying he loves Spock in public, is my logic is in question. I just love that.
Yep, exactly. It's a great moment.
Yeah, speaking of that, while we're talking about Star Trek 3, Brian, you wanted to talk a little bit about the serialization of the movie franchise.
Yeah, you know, what I guess would be considered the middle three Star Trek movies, 2, 3, and 4, actually form a kind of loose trilogy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't designed that way, but it turned out to be that way, that, you know, the death of Spock and Genesis exploding and all those things set into motion what turned out to be the grandest adventure the crew of the Enterprise ever went on.
Yeah.
And that was completely serialized. If you didn't see, I mean, Harv Bennett actually set up Star Trek 3 with a previously on Star Trek at the top of it, basically. So if people stepped into it, they would understand what was going on. That Spock had died and his body was on Genesis, and that's kind of where they leave you. And then the movie opens and Kirk's doing his captain's log, and they kind of fill in some more narration.
Yeah, and in fact, they did that again for The Voyage Home, not in the U.S. because the U.S. is a big, you know, market for Trek, but in markets that weren't big in Trek, they basically did the same kind of little recap thing.
Interesting.
The Voyage Home.
Yeah. Yeah, they did a thing with William Shatner doing like this long...
The Genesis effect.
Right. If you go on YouTube, I'm pretty sure it's on there somewhere.
Oh, it's gotta be, yeah.
Yeah. So that was what I think they call it the accidental trilogy. It just worked out that way, and it is very clearly serialized.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The events that happen in Star Trek 2 carry all the way into Star Trek 4.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That was the only true serialization, I think, that the original cast did.
Yeah, all the other movies just stand on their own.
for the most part. There are threads of this trilogy in The Undiscovered Country.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, when the admiral says those men have literally saved this planet.
He's referring to Kirk can't forgive the death of his son and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few things in there that carry over, but it's obviously not truly serialized. It's just calling back to previous events, obviously.
Right.
But yeah, that was the only time the original cast did anything like that, because back in the 60s, while there was some serialization on television, Star Trek, for the most part, stayed away from it.
Yeah.
You know, in the 60s, I think The Fugitive was on, and The Fugitive was kind of loosely serialized. Richard Kimball was even though you'd have standalone episodes, Richard Kimball was always on the lookout for the one-armed man to clear his name. I think The Prisoner, Patrick McGowan's The Prisoner.
Oh, yeah, The Prisoner
was also somewhat serialized.
Yeah.
But those were the exception to the rule. Most shows were like Star Trek was, where, like Matt said, you were dealing with syndication. You wanted to sell these shows to syndicated markets in large blocks, you know, 80, 100 episodes, whatever it might be. So, yeah, viewers could just step into it one night and see a self-contained story, and they'd be happy. And you didn't have to worry about viewers being frustrated that they might have walked in on part two or something like that.
Yeah.
And hey, let's face it, without syndication, we wouldn't have the franchise, because that's where the original series really, you know, bloomed and took off.
And they have a few moments of continuity, and there's a difference between, like, continuity and serialization, right? Because, you know, when Harry Mudd shows up a second time, you don't absolutely need to have seen the first, I Mudd to appreciate it when you see him the second time.
Right.
But it helps. And then I seem to recall that they wanted to – one of the challenges to doing more dedicated serialization is scheduling, because I think they wanted to have John Colicos be like the recurring Klingon adversary of the the Enterprise.
Oh, yeah.
And when he wasn't available, they said, oh, we'll create, you know, Koloth this time and Kang the next time and whoever the next time. Because it just everything didn't line up perfectly. Because when you really want to be dedicated and to a serialized format, and this is something that Game of Thrones struggles with a lot, is you have to have these actors. You have to pay them for the whole season, right? Because they're on call for that.
Yeah, it's just reserve them.
Yeah, and if you have, John Delancey just show up once a year, that's a little bit easier to fit into his schedule than saying, okay, well, we need to have you in 10 of the 20 episodes this year.
Right.
Yeah, so there was like you said, there was some continuity here and there, and there was only one two-parter in the original series, which was The Menagerie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other than that, they really didn't follow up on anything from previous installments for the most part. They were just self-contained stories. And that tradition carried into TNG as well. For the most part. A few two-parters here and there. Klingon Civil War, obviously, was something. But they didn't really want to do too many things to confuse viewers, potentially, or frustrate viewers.
No. They wanted to go with what works.
The syndication market was always being thought about.
It is somewhat insulting to think that, like, you can't figure out that you just happen to see, like, you know, part one of three about the Klingon Civil War or something.
Yeah.
That's kind of, you know.
But there's so much money. Even now, there's still so much money in the syndication market.
Oh, really?
That you want it to be syndication friendly. I mean, Rick Berman was very much in this mindset, at least during TNG, because he and Gene, I think, pushed back on doing Family.
Yes, episode Family. They did.
Because they didn't want people to feel like they had to follow up to, like, they had to have seen Best of Both Worlds in order to have watched Family.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you know, Ron Moore and I think Michael Piller maybe won the argument, basically saying you can't not have Picard go through this and not follow up on it somehow.
Yeah.
You can't just send the Enterprise on its next mission and Picard be all hunky dory. You have to deal with this. It has to be done.
Right.
So that was probably one of the first instances where the show kind of did a little serialized thing, where it's kind of like the epilogue to Best of Both Worlds.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it very much is.
And in the long run, that episode is more important than Best of Both Worlds, because that's the episode that claims Best of Both Worlds in the Trek legacy, as a Picard episode when, if you watch it as it is, it's actually a Riker episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But it was the episode that finally made me completely warm up to Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very important. A lot of
people. Yeah.
I think that was also at the point that Patrick Stewart's star power was such that he was in control of the character more than any of the writers were. Because if you look at when it started out, he was such a different captain, where his defining quality is that he hates children.
And, yes. Oh, yeah. So yeah. Annoying.
And so to have him...
Picard was written very stiffly. Patrick performed him stiffly, too.
Yeah. Yeah. There was more than wrong with the first season of TNG than just Wesley. Let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But then I guess that kind of kicked off the fourth season of TNG in that direction of serialization, because we see a lot more of it in that season than I think in any of the other ones, because so much builds up to the Klingon Civil War, because we have the stuff with when Kalar comes back and Worf kills Gowron in that episode. I think it's called Reunion, if I remember. And then later
you mean
when
Duras.
We... Pardon? You oh, did Duras. I say Gowron? Duras. Well, yeah. He Gowron would get his day. Worf can kill, has plenty of time.
Yeah, that's later.
Yeah, that would take a little while. And then we have the Mind's Eye, where Geordi gets brainwashed by the Romulans. And all of these would be building up to the season 4 finale. So I guess that's as close as TNG got with that.
Yep.
And then we'd see a couple more references to the Borg in that season. Like when they meet Chief O'Brien's old captain, and he says to Riker, "Damn fine work you did with the Borg, son. We all owe you for that." Or in the what's the one? The Drumhead, where there's that sort of witch hunting admiral who says to Picard, "Have you completely recovered from your experience with the Borg?" So I guess that may be the reason why I like season 4 so much. Is it does have those elements.
It does.
Yeah, but not so much that you can't pluck a single episode out and just watch it on its own.
Which, like I said, was all Rick Berman was worried about.
Yeah. And now, so with Deep Space Nine, you mentioned that, Matt, they did a lot more with serialized storytelling, with Dominion stuff. Particularly, I remember the beginning of season 6, they did like a 6-parter arc, right?
Yeah.
Where they go through the whole, like, recapturing the space station, and it culminated with Worf and Dax's wedding. And it's like 6 or 7 episodes in a row. Did this work for Deep Space Nine, or was it a little bit too much?
Oh, I never had a problem with it. I always liked it.
No, me neither. Yeah. No, me too.
I think Deep Space Nine had a pretty good, like, they knew how to strike a balance with that when they were finally able to.
Yeah, it felt like after that beginning to season 6, they would kind of alternate where they'd have arc heavy episodes and then standalone episodes. They do it in a way where you can really appreciate both. Like, there's that episode, Take Me Out to the Holosuite, in season 7, which is a very lighthearted baseball game. And that is in the middle. It's like a respite from the war. But you don't need to have seen the previous 3 episodes to know exactly what's happening in that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, they get lots of little things like that. Like, asides with the... and there's others, too. Like, the little asides they would do with the Ferengi, you know, with the Quark's little world, or like, you know, the Grand Nagus would appear, send Quark on some ridiculous thing in the middle of the war, right? They're these little detours.
Yeah, it would be like branches of the main storyline, but not so intimately connected to it.
Right.
And then I think for the very end of season 7, it was like 8 episodes in a row that were all building up to the finale.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly. So that works pretty well. You know, when you're building up to something like that, you don't want the ending to just come out of nowhere. You want there to be some build-up.
Indeed.
Okay. Now we wanted to talk a little bit about Voyager. And Matt, you said you recently did a Voyager rewatch. So are there any moments from Voyager that maybe could have benefited from a little more serialization than the show got? Because while Deep Space Nine took that risk and did more... had more continuity and ongoing storylines, I feel like Voyager had less of that.
Yeah, and of course Voyager was also very much under the microscope because it was launching UPN, so like, I mean, you can imagine there were probably 3 different notes, you know, 3 different like people's notes coming in, because there was the UPN, there was Paramount, you know, domestic television, And then there's, you know, like Berman, right? So you can imagine they're getting notes from three different places, you know, about everything on Voyager. So I do not envy them for trying to launch UPN. They probably got so many notes. It's kind of ridiculous.
You know, I never thought about it like that, but that makes perfect sense that they had less room to play because the suits at UPN were like, hey, we see this incredibly popular series you had going for 7 years. Just keep doing that.
Yeah. You know that thing? Do it again. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. The show is very, very risk averse.
Yeah.
Right. Very much so. In fact, I think to its own detriment, we've all probably talked about this before, but just I think that part of the serialization, or actually this is really just continuity more than anything, I think they really should have held on to the arc, if you can call it an arc, because it was almost resolved instantly, of the fact that the Maquis people should not really just kind of fit in right away, right?
Yeah.
There should be
yeah.
more friction.
Yeah.
And they darn near just have it all resolved within the first few episodes of this first season.
Yeah, they basically have it resolved in the first episode.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some lip service in another episode. Mid-season.
There's one awesome episode where it's revealed that Tuvok has been running like holographic drills on what to happen if the Maquis mutiny.
One.
That episode is fantastic because that's exactly what Tuvok should be doing as a security chief.
Right, because in theory, these guys could totally just change their minds and decide to revolt. Right, it never happens, but as you said, that's realistic. That he should have been prepared for that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was a good
there
episode.
Could have been some cool serialization there, no doubt.
Yeah, so I and that's a missed opportunity in general. And again, I think like just like we were saying, I think that comes from the notes that say, hey, remember, you know, TNG was super successful and that just finished? Yeah, do that again, but for UPN now. You know what I mean? They had those notes just sort of breathing down their neck. But in a larger sense, I do wish Voyager had been able to escape that, you know, the gaze of all the network suits, because I think it would have benefited from more serialization. And specifically, of course, the you know, one of the most well-known Voyager episodes, one of the best, or is a two-parter called Year of Hell. And honestly,
so good.
It's so good, but the title of the episode is Year of Hell. Why was it only two episodes?
Yeah.
Why?
Like, yeah, now
that doesn't make sense.
For myself, as well as anyone else who's not super familiar with those episodes, can you tell us more about what happens in them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. So, and you guys can help me fill this in if I've glossed over something that's important, but there's a timeship captain who's named Anorax, who's basically kind of a Moby, you know, it's kind of a Moby Dick story, right? He's obsessed with the white whale that is restoring his people, and specifically his family, and his people to their former glory. So he's constantly messing with the timelines, you know, and of course these all have like ripple effects in the timelines. So every time he like wipes out a random species of the quadrant, just because like, you know, a model has calculated that maybe it can restore his, the Krenim, right? The Krenim Empire or something like that, back to their former glory. And so he's constantly tinkering with things outside of time. You know, his ship can exist outside of normal space-time. And so he's constantly sort of resetting things, trying things, you know, nuking a species off the face of time to see what happens. And of course, our intrepid crew notices this. I don't remember, you know, through what manner, but they become aware of him and end up sort of caught up in his obsessions. And it, of course, takes its toll on Voyager big time. But by the end of the second, by the middle sort of the whole thing, Voyager is, like, the ship itself is just an absolute mess. It's one of those classic pictures of Voyager that a lot of people have probably seen where just Voyager is beat to hell. It's, you know, missing hull plating. It's in terrible shape having gone through this year, you know, this year, at least this virtual year, like, of hell, as he constantly changes things, resets things. They're trying to stop him and get some of their people back that he's taken. Like Chakotay is on there. Well, anyway, this is a thing that seems like it could have continued in, you know, in various ways for much more than two episodes.
Yeah, that could have been a whole season, a whole year, as it were.
Yeah, yep.
Which
exactly.
I think that's what some of the writers wanted to do it that way, right? Like they'd plan it out and say, let's really double down on this.
I'm not sure, but you can I would imagine that they would like to do that. And of course, we're probably told no. But I can imagine they'd like to.
It would have shaken up the format quite a bit. It would have been good. Yeah. It would have really given that show a shot in the arm.
Yeah. It really needed it.
It would have been great. So I think that's maybe the biggest missed opportunity, like, of Voyager is that sort of that's like kind of the midpoint for Voyager seasonally. That's about a midpoint for them anyway. And then, it would have been a great shakeup.
Well, one of the advantages of serialization is you can invest more in supporting characters, which is one of the things that's so strong about Deep Space Nine is they have such a deep bench. I mean, Gul Dukat is the best villain in all of Star Trek because he's the one we got to see 70 different times, right? And we got to see him change over.
Right. And you can watch him be a scumbag in different ways.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and sometimes be heroic. I mean, there's a couple times where he saves Captain Sisko's life.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, and complex.
And one of the liabilities of episodic storytelling is the red shirt phenomenon where we need to up the stakes by killing some random crew member, but if we're not invested with them at all, then it doesn't really mean anything. And speaking of Voyager, there's this one episode that I think of where it really could have benefited from serialization. Well, it's called Ashes to Ashes, and what happens is...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, there's this officer named Lindsay Ballard who is supposedly Harry Kim's best friend since the Academy. And they got this really good actress. Her name is Kim Rhodes to play her, so they had some good chemistry there, but I think we meet her after she has died, right? And so
correct.
Harry's
they
all
make a new person, a new name, and it's stupid because they've lost people. There are names we know of people who've been lost. Why did they not just resurrect a previous actress, a previous character, a previous actress who's gone? Because there are people that we know their names, we've seen them in engineering or something, and they've died, and it's like, what, why did we invent this person only to be told, oh no, she was on Voyager for years and knew Kim, but sure, whatever, we've never seen her before.
it was dumb, so we can't be invested in it at all.
That was a shame.
Yeah, I mean, it's like when Tasha Yar died, like, it was so shocking because we'd been with her for, two-thirds of a season. And then instead, Lindsay Ballard is gone, and it's like, wait, what? Why do I care about this?
Who?
Oh, because I'm told I'm supposed to care about this.
Right, because that's Harry's BFF with, maybe benefits or something.
Yeah.
We don't know. But yeah, it was not a smart move, and I'm not sure why they did it. And I'm sure they sort of kicked themselves afterwards, in retrospect, I'm sure they're like, dang, why did we do that? Why did we invent someone out of thin air?
Yeah, there's also limitations that we're not as sensitive to in terms of, I mentioned actors' schedules before, but then there's also like royalties to writers for creating characters. I mean, the famous example is that Tom Paris is actually Nick Locarno from the First Duty, but they changed his name. So then they don't have to pay the writer royalties, which is actually kind of a dick move by the producers when you think about it, because they took the writer's idea, right? To the point that they even cast the same actor, right? Yeah. And so that may have been a thing where if they bring back some character that we've seen three times before, that there might be some royalties that they need to pay, and that may stretch the budget or whatever. I don't know.
There's always that possibility.
Yeah, and again, like to my Spider-Man example, if you're doing a comic book, it doesn't matter. You can bring characters back as much as you need to because nobody owns them, because the company owns them, which is one of the advantages of creators not owning their own characters, right?
Yeah, but that same principle applies to TV shows too, Jared.
Explain.
The guy who created the Nick Locarno character.
Sold the script, right?
Sold the script and is owned by Paramount Pictures. It doesn't really matter.
Are you sure? Because I think
there's no copyright on that.
But Jared's right. That's the reason they gave for that. And that's what I don't. It's kind of confusing.
There's some screenwriters guild thing. Which anyway, we don't need to burrow super deep into that. We'll let smart listeners explain it to us in the comment section below.
Indeed.
Oh, okay. So, So something that I feel compelled to always mention, you know, we just went back and forth a lot on Deep Space Nine and Voyager, is that both of these shows, while they were more successful financially, were happening in the shadow of, I think, the more creatively influential Babylon 5, which really kicked off serialized storytelling, in, I think, on TV dramas in a way that nothing else had before at the time, right? Because they started telling week-by-week stories like in 1995, taking advantage of this very young technology of the internet for people to be able to follow up on previous stories and say, oh yeah, here's a picture of something that happened in an episode 6 weeks ago that's maybe relevant. And that thing they did on Babylon 5 is the first season was entirely episodic. The second season was kind of alternating, where it was like maybe a third serialized, two-thirds episodic. Then the third and fourth seasons were just basically one straight storyline all the way through. And then the fifth season, they went back to the episodic. And so I think they probably ratcheted up a little bit too much. And part of that was their concern is they were always afraid they were going to get canceled. So they had to rush through the storyline a little bit more than others. But my preference is that kind of format where we alternate between having an arc, but then also having individual episodes. Because as much as we may look back and say, oh gosh, I wish they'd been able to tell bigger stories in Next Generation, I know that I rewatch more of that because I can just grab one episode at a, you know, and watch that on its own while I'm eating dinner.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Right?
Yep. It's like a grab and go kind of a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing we want to talk about a little bit is, of course, the influence of Battlestar Galactica, because that got big after Enterprise went off the air, and that's intensely serialized. And that's really was really advantageous when it was on the air. And I remember, like, every Sunday afternoon in 2007, that's what me and my roommates did, is we sat down and we just plowed through Battlestar Galactica DVDs. But since the series went off the air, I don't think I've sat down and said, oh, I will watch one episode of Battlestar. Because I feel like if I do that, I have to watch all four seasons, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
So I think they kind of went over the top with it.
Yeah, well, that was Battlestar Galactica was Ron Moore's reaction to some of the shackles placed on him while he was doing Star Trek.
Oh,
yeah,
sure,
definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Including the serialization aspect. It used to drive them crazy that Rick Berman would not let them serialize stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when Ron finally was out on his own, he said, "The hell with it! I am going to do exactly the kind of show I want to do."
Yeah, I remember even reading like that. Rick Berman didn't want them to bring back villains from previous episodes. So, like, when the crystalline entity came back a second time, that was, like, a major win for the writers.
Yeah.
Oh, I totally believe that. That's kind of ridiculous, but I totally believe it, you know?
Yeah.
They used to have weird issues, I mean, about even referring to original series characters and stuff. There was a whole big thing about mentioning Spock in the Sarek episode that was a big to-do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because they just refer to Sarek's son. Oh, no. Yeah, oh, no.
And then Ira Bear had to, like, really get on Rick's ass about it, and he finally gave in and said, okay, you can say Spock.
That was a weird Gene Roddenberry rule of, like, he wanted this total break from TOS to TNG, you know, and he was like, we don't need to look backward, you know, and talk about those people. We're moving forward, you know, kind of thing. And it was a really weird, just a weird, you know, dictatorial thing that Roddenberry had.
Yeah. Anyway, we're probably digressing.
I never heard that. No, it's germane. It's still in the topic of continuity. Any other thoughts on Babylon 5 or Battlestar Galactica? Because they're not Star Trek, but they are important in talking about the context of the franchise.
Yeah, well, and I think you can see a little bit of BSG influence on Discovery.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Oh, so. Sure. Yeah, episode 3 felt like I was back on the Galactica.
Yeah.
When she's there in the little prison shuttle. Mm-hmm. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. It's very BSG.
Yeah, sometimes it's not subtle. Yeah.
Well, and of course, a fun thing was that the 133 jumps done at the fall finale was a purposeful little homage to the episode 33. Yep. Which is awesome.
Yeah, that's cute.
That was fun.
That's nice that they did that.
Yeah, that's
great. There's a humility to that I appreciate, because they acknowledge, hey, we're the biggest kid on the block, but we're not the only kid on the block.
No, these days, I don't even know if you can consider Star Trek the biggest kid on the block at this point.
Well, in terms of episodic science fiction or televised science fiction drama. I mean,
sure.
It's the
but like modern clout in the 21st century. I don't know.
No, definitely not.
Yeah,
definitely.
They're
not.
Trying, and I hope they do. I hope we get our sort of top, you know, top shelf kind of clout back. But we'll see.
Fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of not being the only kid on the block right now, also we have the Orville, and what comments do you, because they've made a specific decision, we're just going to do this like old school TNG, we're just going to be episodic. What has been your two reactions by you two gentlemen to that?
I think it's fine. I enjoy it as a standalone. I mean, they do pick up on a few things character based in a few episodes, but for the most part, yeah, it's just like TNG. Next, another week, another adventure.
Yeah, and I certainly enjoy that. It's an enjoyable kind of like, here's a little spoonful of this, and like, you know, you can kind of go on your way. And it's enjoyable. It's different. It's certainly different than a lot of other modern TV shows. And I don't think it's bad. I think it's just different, and I think it's enjoyable in a kind of one shot, you know, one and done kind of way that's very pleasing, you know.
Oh, that's
it
good.
Follows the model that most current network shows still do.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. That's
which is a lot of standalone. Yeah. You put on CSI, not CSI, the NCIS or one of those NCIS shows. Yeah, do they do occasional two-parters and multi-parts? Sure. Do they have some thematic threads they might follow throughout the course of the season? Yeah, but for the most part, you can just pick. They're just like any other network show that you may have watched even 40 years ago, where it's just... Every week, no, and I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way, but the standalone format,
it's true,
remains the standard on broadcast television.
Definitely, I sort of chuckle at that, Brian, because it's just funny you brought up NCIS, because when I was really doing better with hitting the gym and stuff, man, when I went to the gym, whatever night we typically went, you know, one of those nights was totally NCIS LA night, and it's actually really entertaining to just like, you know, look up at the TV at the elliptical. And kind of just be like, oh yeah, I have no problem following along with this kind of, you know, whatever standalone, easy to follow little story, because it's true. And then you just kind of go on some little car chase with them while you're, you know, working out and trying to get stuff done. So I kind of chuckle, because that thing totally has a place. You know what I mean?
It does.
I also think episodic stories work better when you have a longer season to fill. Because the idea of filling how many episodes is it for Discovery? 12 episodes, 14?
15.
Okay, so that's you know, I mean like Game of Thrones, they do 10 episodes a year, and I guess this year they did 8, and so to do 15 is quite a bit more than that, but it's still only 15. If you have to do 20 to 26 episodes, you can't shackle yourself with we're going to tell the same story every night. You need to open yourself up to some variety.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean when you listen to what those guys who were in the writers room during, you know, the 26 episodes a week era. Oh, it's a grind, and I feel really I actually feel really bad for them, because they really were just going, we're so burned out. Well, let's just pull a random, you know, standalone story out of thin air, because whatever, and they just do, you know, they just had to.
And yeah, I feel so bad for that context, because the grind must just have been awful. Not just for the writers, but then for the directors too, because then you basically just have to shoot it like a soap opera for efficiency. You can't have any artistry in it at all.
No, I remember we had a really good interview with Ira Stephen Bear on the website not long ago, and he was talking about it, and he says, you know, we know that, you know, no one sets out to make a bad episode, but at the same time, like, dude, if you've made an episode and it's not the greatest, you can't go back. You can't hit stop. You can't go backwards. You've got to just keep producing it, because it's weekly and it's this and it's that. And, you know, you can't just be like, oops, that's not up to our standards. Scrap it. Start over. Like, if you started down that road, you probably just have to push through. You know, you just have to make it. And it is what it is.
Yep, it's like a freight train
barreling
down the track.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's only like, what, typically five, six-ish days to shoot it, you know, the live action part, and that's it. You got to move on to the next episode, you know?
Yep.
So I feel for, you know, when you understand that too, you kind of feel for those guys, and you kind of understand like, yeah, no, of course, especially in 26 episodes, dude, they just can't all be winners, and that's okay. they're all like, you know, on the whole, it's all quite good. You know, all of Trek is quite good overall and quite entertaining.
Sure. So, or else we wouldn't be doing this.
Right. Exactly. We wouldn't be still talking about it. So.
Yeah, I just you and this is where if Kayla were here, she would say, you know, I want to go to the alternate universe where they only had to do 15 episodes of TNG every year and see how good those episodes would have been.
It would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, all the Star Trek shows.
Yeah, be very interesting.
Star Trek is known for being a very, very hard show to write.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because the voice is so specific, and a lot of people can't do it. Brandon Braga has talked about this many times, how they would get some very talented writers to come in, and they simply could not do it.
Huh.
It'll be because it's a very specific thing, and if you can't get the hang of it, it just doesn't work.
Right? Yeah, it bugs me when people rag on Brandon Braga. Not that I'm the biggest fan of his in the world, but he has written more hours of Star Trek than anyone else in the world, and lot of it has been extraordinary.
Yeah, yep. Brandon Braga gets a bad rap.
Totally, he does. Totally.
Yeah,
and his thing that he did so well was the ability to write really different stuff in the context of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, they'd say, okay, well, we've been doing this for 10, 15 years in a row now. Let's give this guy who can do it differently the keys to the kingdom and see what he can do.
Right, right.
Which they did.
And they did. But then, of course, they put all kinds of shackles on him when they let him do it.
And yeah, and I do think Brannon was burning out by then, too.
Oh, sure.
How could you not?
I think everybody involved with the franchise near the end is kind
of
tired.
Yeah, I think in hindsight, they will all kind of tell you that now. You know, look. It was grueling.
Yeah.
It was several years of hell. Is that what you're saying, Matt?
Yes, it was. Several years of hell to bring it back. Well done, Jared.
Thank you.
But Braga is working on the Orville.
He is, indeed. So
he's written some stuff. He's directed a few episodes.
Mm-hmm. Good for him.
Yeah, I think it's kind of been this. I mean, he's friends with Seth MacFarlane. They did Cosmos together. But I also think Brannon, in interviews, kind of waxes nostalgic about TNG.
Sure.
So I guess this is kind of the best and only way he can kind of relive that.
Those guys were so, you know, him and Ron Moore and stuff. I mean, they were like, I think 25 or something.
Yeah, they're 24, so young. 25
years old.
Yeah, they were so young when they did that. So, yeah, I mean, that's like anyone kind of going, well, man, I'm looking back at my 20s, look at all this stuff I did, you know, some glory days kind of stuff. You get nostalgic about it, I think, you know?
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I the thing that always gets me is how, and we're completely digressing now, is how Ron Moore, as a very young man, had the wisdom to write Tapestry of, like, what it feels like for an old man to feel regret. How did he access that part of his brain that was 40 years in the future for him?
Yeah.
I don't know, but you're right. Tapestry is a fantastic episode.
Yeah, it's my favorite episode.
Oh, and it has some continuity, too, so there you go.
Yes, it does. That's right. It picks up very specifically from a season two episode.
Yes, it does. Yeah, from a random season two episode.
Yeah. It's frankly not a very good one.
No, that whole episode is basically worth it for the Wesley Picard moments, basically.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I do like the line... we look for things to make us go. That's a memorable line.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, Packlids.
Yeah, the beloved Packlids. That is racist. You should know to separate race from culture.
Uh-oh, I've stereotyped. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Matt.
Oh, for shame.
The other thing is, if different sentient species have different evolutionary tracks and different biology and different neurology, you actually could stereotype, right?
Oh, sure.
I mean, like, if the part of a Klingon's brain that controls aggression is larger than a human's, you can say, scientifically, Klingons are more aggressive than humans.
Yeah, and I think the Klingons would be the first to be like, yeah, we are.
Screw yeah, you. And if you didn't, they would teach you a lesson in pain.
Yeah, firsthand, they would give you firsthand experience, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All righty, well, let's close the book on this and put it back on the shelf. We're glad to have been able to come back to a traditional episode of the Shuttle Pod, episode 43, which we have recorded on November 27th, 2017. So Brian had a great idea for a forthcoming episode of the Shuttle Pod, where to make it more interactive, where we answer questions from our readership. And so if you have questions that you want us to discuss, points you think maybe we could go in detail, feedback from previous episodes. If you want to leave a comment on either on this thread that you'll have for this article or for future article where we solicit questions specifically, please hit us up. Let us know what you want us to talk about, what specific questions you have for the four of us in our podcasting. And we would be delighted to be able to read that on air and then respond to it. So I'm not sure if that'll be next episode or a couple episodes from now, but it's something I think we absolutely want to do before we Discovery gets back on the air in January, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, yeah. Definitely.
Okay. So feedback is welcome.
Thanks for listening. And if you really liked this podcast, and we hope you did, we'd really like your feedback. It really helps us out to head to the iTunes store and rate us, give us feedback there. It really helps us and bumps us up in the ratings, and so we really appreciate it. So
indeed.
So thanks, guys. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Take care.
Bye, everybody.